During the COVID pandemic, the biggest battle was over personal freedom versus public health.
There was no easy solution, but we in the United States did not find a happy medium between keeping people safe and alive and keeping an economy up and running.
That's Ronald Gruner. We talk with him about how and why our institutions struggled so badly during the COVID pandemic. His book is COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. Then it's getting harder and harder to get published. But Dennis Sweeney has a solution. We talk with him about his book, How to Submit, Getting Your Writing Published with Literary Magazines and Small Presses. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before he retired, Ronald Gruner was an engineer, not a public health expert. But he brought his engineering skills of methodical, detailed, and dispassionate investigation to bear when he decided to write a factual record of how the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded and how institutions responded. Gruner especially wanted to document how our institutions handled the central questions society faced, how to balance personal freedom with public health. His book, COVID Wars, is an in-depth history of the COVID years and how our institutions responded. He reflects on the successes and failures of the U.S. response, the role of science and misinformation, and the lasting implications for society. Ronald Gruner, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Francesca. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yes, this is a topic I'm very interested in. Although many people seem to be wanting desperately to move on from it, what motivated you to write such a comprehensive history of the COVID pandemic in the U.S., COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom?
Well, first of all, Francesca, you are absolutely right that many people want to move on from COVID. I mean, it was a very painful period for the country and for people individually and families, of course. But the reason I decided to write COVID, it took some prodding from friends and writing associates that perhaps a nonpartisan objective recounting of the pandemic would be useful not only today, but for future generations, our grandchildren, our children, and historians. And after thinking about that a bit, I realized that the worst before the 2020 pandemic, the worst pandemic to hit the United States was in 1918, the Spanish flu pandemic. And it wasn't until 1957 that a good overview of that 1918 pandemic was written that described what happened and what was involved. And I thought perhaps I could do that now because I and people I know, we all lived through that. And perhaps I could give a recounting of what it was actually like at the time, which, of course, for us was just a few years ago. But for my grandchildren, perhaps that'll be 20, 30, 50 years ago even. So that was really my perspective on that.
And you compare your book, COVID Wars, to Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year. So going even much further back to 1665, what parallels between the 1665 Great Plague of London and the COVID-19 pandemic struck you most powerfully?
Well, there were many parallels, but I think the largest single parallel was generally the amount of misinformation, people not really knowing what was going on, and people being to some extent in denial about it, because many people left London at the time that could afford to do it, but many that could afford to do it even chose to stay, not believing it was necessarily a real pandemic. Although I will say that was in the minority back in 1665, because they didn't have the kind of communication that we have today. Today we have social media and cable news and so many various channels where anybody who wants to voice an opinion can, and people that tend to be opinionated in a particular direction tend to motivate to those channels, and they get their beliefs reinforced. So during the pandemic of 2020, the one that we lived through, there were many different beliefs about COVID itself, how serious was it, was a political hoax, about vaccines, for example. There was a lot of misunderstanding about that. That happened in 1665 also, but not to the extent that we have that we had today in 2020. So that was the primary difference, but also a very similar factor. But another factor that was very similar is both in 2020 and our pandemic and in 1665, lockdowns were very, very much disliked. In London in 1665, they were really draconian. If an individual from a family in a house developed the plague, the entire house was locked up, quarantined, and guarded for 40 days. Obviously, food was brought in, but they could not leave the house, and that was a horrible situation. And oftentimes, because they were quarantined with really no help, most of the household died. Now, the effect of lockdowns in the United States in 2020, 21, 22 weren't that serious, but they did have negative effects, of course. So that was another similarity in that regard. The last thing I mentioned, I kind of hinted on, Francesca, was that the people in London that could afford to leave London and leave the plague and go out to their country estates or at a minimum just leave the crowded city, most of those people actually did, including the King of England. And of course, we saw the same migration in 2020 and 21, where people moved out of the large cities that could afford to. They bought houses in Florida and areas where they were relatively isolated. And we saw real estate prices just skyrocket because those people were moving out of crowded areas into areas less crowded, the ones that could afford to do it. So there were many similarities between 1665 and 2020 and 2021. And that was one of the reasons after reading that recounting of the plague in 1665 that I chose to write the book COVID Wars to talk about the similarities.
Yeah. And what have we learned from previous pandemics? I mean, 1665, going back that far, it might be hard to say that we've learned much. But the 1918 Spanish flu, what lessons from that pandemic were either forgotten or ignored in the early days of COVID?
Well, I would say that the pandemic of 1918, the Spanish flu, and then the smaller Asian flu pandemic of 1957, we had forgotten all the lessons of both of those pandemics by 2020. We learned very, very little because what was actually experienced in those times had been forgotten. So we did not benefit by that, unfortunately.
Well, what were some of those lessons?
Well, I think during the 1918 Spanish flu, there were issues about to what extent you should do social distancing and even lockdowns. And probably the most interesting lesson, which I recount in my book, was the experience of two cities, Philadelphia and St. Louis. In September of 1918, when the Spanish flu was approaching its peak, which would peak in October and November of that year, the two cities took very different approaches to how to manage the pandemic in 1918. Philadelphia chose to have a Liberty Bond parade where 200,000 people participated in a parade honoring the soldiers from 1918 and World War I as the war was coming to an end and selling Liberty Bonds to finance the war. 200,000 people participated in that. On the other hand, St. Louis, although the were offered to have a parade, many cities were, they chose not to do that, and they kept businesses closed and no parade, even though business people, of course, objected to that because that hurt business. The bottom line on that is that by the end of the year, 1918, my number's a little bit fuzzy at this point, but basically Philadelphia had something in the range of 20,000 Spanish flu deaths in the last 4 months of 1918, starting with the parade they had in September, about 20,000, whereas St. Louis, which chose not to do that and basically kept people isolated, had less than 3,000. So there was a huge difference in death rates based on how people practiced, I hate to use the term lockdown, but for lack of a better term, I'll use that, and social distancing. That lesson had largely been forgotten, how large the effect was between areas that chose to really follow the directions of public health, which said you should not have a parade of 200,000 people, and areas that actually ignored that. And we saw similar things in the United States where I give an example in my book. Let's take two counties in Texas, Midland County, Texas, and Travis County, Texas. Midland County has a younger population by a significant margin than Travis County in Texas does, but they chose for their own reasons, to minimize social distancing, not to do any lockdowns, and the vaccination rates were quite low. Whereas Travis County tended to respect the opinion of public health officials, practiced social distancing more. They did not do complete lockdowns, but were much more highly vaccinated. And the difference in death rates during the pandemic between those two counties, just a couple of hundred miles apart, based on how they approached public health issues, were a factor of a difference of two, almost three, in terms of death rates during the pandemic. So that's a lesson that was not learned from St. Louis and Philadelphia in 1918, that was repeated again in city and state and county time and time again during our pandemic.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ronald Gruner about his book, COVID Wars: America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. I remember the early days. There seemed to be a lot of social solidarity in the early days. Of course, we didn't have a vaccine then. In the beginning, people seemed to come together, but that fairly quickly fell apart. And of course, there are a number of reasons for that. The initial confusion around COVID, there were muddled messages, there was censorship in China, and contradictory signals from President Trump, who just kept on reiterating that it was just going to go away, and then quickly followed by a division between states that were serious about a lockdown and other states. You know, I mean, I remember one politician saying that older people should be willing to sacrifice themselves so that the business could get back in business. So how did early communications impact the public's perception and their evolving response to the crisis?
Well, people were getting messages from many different sources, like you point out. Cable news, I'll be very specific. Fox News, for example, in the early period in February and early March, many of their respected commentators were declaring that the pandemic was a political hoax designed to damage President Trump during an election year. And that message was coming through loud and clear over cable news channels. Other channels basically said, well, it may not be a political hoax, but it's not nearly as serious as people are making it out to be. Actually, it's no worse than the flu. So you don't really have to worry that much about that. And that's all fact. That's all available in my book and other books that recount those exact quotations, which did, I think, a serious disservice to Americans getting that disinformation, because it simply wasn't true. President Trump, I think, in some respects, tried his best, but he also was in an election year, and he was following his base, in my opinion. On March 13th, I believe it was, he declared a national emergency, a national medical emergency because of COVID, and urged people to stay in the homes, do everything they can to avoid other social contact, to minimize the transmission of the disease. I mean, that's the speech he made on March 13th, 2020. And that at the time was good advice, because people were dying, beginning to die at several thousand a day, and hospitals were becoming overwhelmed. We heard about New York City, where people were dying at such a rate they had to bring in, unfortunately, freezer trucks to hold the dead, which is a horrible tragedy. But that was true. But then as lockdowns began to take effect, in particular as the lockdowns were costing jobs and where people were losing their jobs or they couldn't go to work and losing their income, there was naturally a strong reaction, a negative reaction to that, and people were having protests around the country. And President Trump, in my opinion, rather than explaining to people why those actions were necessary and why they may be painful at times, so they were necessary, basically completely changed and were sending out tweets like Liberate Michigan, for example, when people were protesting in Michigan about the lockdowns, and was encouraging people to protest and embedded comments about the Second Amendment in there and all kinds of things like that, and really politicized the pandemic. And that started 3 weeks after he had declared a national medical emergency. So people were getting a very mixed message from cable media, from social media, and perhaps worse, from the President of the United States.
Yeah, a lot of mixed messages, I think, were to be had on all parts. I mean, I remember early on hearing Tony Fauci, Dr. Fauci, poo-pooing the use of masks. And I used to be an educator in the field of occupational health, and I used to teach infection control. And, you know, I know that masks are effective, and I was really shocked when he did that. And of course, now we know that the reason he did that was because we did not have adequate PPE for the frontline medical personnel who were dealing with a COVID crisis. And so rather than leveling with people and appealing to their patriotism or their communal consciousness, he just tried to tell people that they weren't effective. And I think that did a lot to undermine his credibility.
Oh, you're so right. I mean, I think Dr. Fauci, at a personal and professional level, he had the best of intentions, but he was a terrible communicator through much of the pandemic. And he sent very mixed messages. Now, that particular quotation you're referring to, I believe at the time, you might recall that this was in early February when he made that quotation, or middle February. It was believed that COVID was transmitted primarily over surfaces, and we were all cleaning off our surfaces when we came in from the grocery store and wiping down packages and that type of thing. And they didn't believe it was transmitted over the air quite so much. So his actual quote, if you go back and look at that, which was oftentimes the latter part was deleted, was he saying, at this point in time, masks do not appear to be effective, but that could change. But what people remember is, at this point in time, masks are not effective, or masks are not effective or necessary. And he made that mistake a number of times during the pandemic and confused people badly. And that got everybody off to the wrong foot, as well as the other things I mentioned. Many of our public health officials were very, very good professionally, but they had very poor public communication skills, and at a minimum should have been trained how to deliver critical messages to the public in a clear and concise and consistent manner, which they did not do.
Now, of course, all this happens within a media environment, with social media, with cable TV, with all kinds of partisanship. And I have to say, when I talk about the partisanship, I don't think it's equal on both sides. I think the Democrats really did try to do a better job in communicating, although maybe they had their own problems as well. Talk about the actual impact on the ground of death rates from COVID. Talk about the difference in red areas versus blue areas in terms of death rates.
Well, I will in a minute, but I'd like to just comment on a comment you made about Democrats. Democrats did their share of damage, too. And let me give you an example I mentioned in my book. Keep in mind that 2020 was an election year. And in the late summer and early fall of 2020, Joe Biden, who was running for president against Donald Trump, basically said, I'm not sure I trust the vaccines. I trust our medical establishment, but I don't trust Donald Trump because I think Donald Trump may be pushing vaccines too quickly to get them announced before election day to help him win the election. So I trust the pharmaceutical companies, but not Donald Trump. And that was some of the seeds of vaccine hesitancy that were spread by Democrats starting in the late summer of 2020. But what's strange, Francesca, about that is that when Biden won the election, the Democrats tended to embrace vaccines, whereas the Republicans, which were who you would think would support vaccines because they were developed by Donald Trump, that was one of his greatest successes during his 4 years, were very vaccine hesitant. So it was really on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, that caused a lot of damage to this country.
I did not know about that. I hadn't caught that, so I appreciate it. And I also think that after Biden became president, he does not have a stellar record. The pandemic was still going on, and there was really a lot of taking away of important public health measures under Biden, as well as had been under Trump, but in different circumstances, maybe more regional. You know, I want to talk about vaccines for a minute, this vaccine hesitancy, because, of course, before the COVID pandemic, rates of vaccines of all kinds were high enough, for example, with the measles vaccine or polio vaccine and others, to really allow for some herd immunity. And since then, they have dropped below that, in some cases, in some areas, precipitously, going from like 90 5% down to 80%, which is really inadequate. And, you know, I think one reason was that people did not trust the pharmaceutical companies. I personally have had a struggle with this because I'm very pro-vaccine. I remember getting measles when I was a kid because there wasn't a vaccine at that time, and I wanted to die. I was so sick. At the age of 9, I wanted to die.
Yeah.
And I did not get COVID. I've had 5 shots of the vaccine, and yet I've had a vaccine injury, which is rare but happens. I'm still dealing with it. It's a peripheral neuropathies. It's a thing. It happens. And I have struggled with even talking about this because with so much vaccine hesitancy and disinformation being spread around, legitimate concerns about safety of vaccines then become politicized and people can't investigate them. And people like myself are kind of left out in the cold.
Well, that's unfortunately true. As I'm sure you know, every pharmaceutical, every drug has counter reactions. A very, very small percentage of people that take 80 milligrams of aspirin every day to act as a blood thinner because of a cardiac condition, a very, very small percentage die because of that, just taking aspirin. So every drug has counter reactions, but all in all, we make decisions, hopefully, in public health that by far the greater good is to take pharmaceuticals, whether that's aspirin or vaccines, even though in isolated cases they have adverse effects, like neuropathy, like you mentioned. So that's an issue. But once again, we had people, and I would hold Robert F. Kennedy Jr. largely responsible for the vaccine hesitancy, who basically was making comments that were just absolutely wrong. I mean, he was quoted a number of times that vaccines are killing more people than COVID itself. That was just irresponsible. That was wrong. And many people believed it. And as a consequence, the rate of vaccination, even across states, ranged from roughly 50% of the population. And I believe that was Mississippi, although I may be wrong about that, but that's outlined in my book specifically, to as high as 80% in states like Vermont and other New England states, Massachusetts, for example. So the death rates were proportional to those vaccination rates in general, that the states that were highly vaccinated had significantly lower death rates than those that were not vaccinated. Now, there's a complication there, though, in that even before COVID hit the nation, the death rates across the states varied significantly, or let's say the lifespan. So states with long lifespans, such as Massachusetts, the average lifespan was over 80 years. States with shorter lifespans, named Mississippi and Louisiana, and many of the southern states, the lifespan was 75 years or younger. That's a difference of 5 or 6 years. Now, that doesn't mean much when you're 20 years old. You don't think too much about that. When you're my age, 78 years old, that means a lot, an extra 5 years of life. So even before the COVID pandemic, we had large differences. And unfortunately, the states which had the shorter lifespans to start with were the ones that were the most vaccine hesitant and had underlying health issues, which contributed to higher death rates.
Your subtitle, Ronald Gruner, in COVID Wars is America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. And these are seen as contradictory to each other in the minds of many people. Talk about the balance of public health and personal freedom. I mean, you point out that there were really impacts of closing down schools, of closing down workplaces. Let's put partisanship aside for a moment. How should the public health be balanced with personal freedoms? What kinds of guidelines are necessary?
Well, that's a complex question because when I talk about personal freedom, I also talk about economic freedom too. And the states that tended to really respect their public health guidelines and close their schools and kept their schools closed for a year or more, including, quote, non-essential businesses, which oftentimes was a mistake in what they considered essential and non-essential. Those states had lower death rates, but they had a significantly larger economic impact. In other words, much higher unemployment. So there was indeed a trade-off between a state selecting to keep everything open and focus on maintaining employment primarily, and sacrificing public health. That was a trade-off states consciously made. States like South Dakota made decisions like that. They had high death rates in 2020 because they remained open and after that, but they had much lower economic impact. So there was a true trade-off there, and it was hard to find the middle ground. You know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when a ship would come into harbor that was carrying, say, a typhoid, for example, they were quarantined for 40 days before they could even enter the harbor. That was a necessary requirement 100 years ago to keep that from transmitting into the city, but that had a huge economic effect on shipping. And that's kind of the way it is. If you want to keep people safe, until we have much better medicine, you have to keep them isolated at many times until you have things that can treat that. And that's a trade-off. That's a difficult one to make. And in the states, being a federal republic, we allow every state to make their own decisions, which is what happened.
Well, what about the example of other countries that were also struggling with the same issue of balancing personal freedom with public health? I mean, with the caveat that if you get COVID because you've had an excess of personal freedom, you can be dead. But, you know, what kinds of lessons can we derive from countries that were more successful in making this balance?
Well, that's really a good question. Just to put a little bit of context there, is in my book, I analyze 20 developed countries, the 20 largest developed countries, excluding China, because we don't have good data from China. And of those 20 countries, the United States, unfortunately had the highest death rate per million of those 20 countries, and also had the largest impact on employment during the pandemic, I mean, the largest loss of employment during the pandemic. So we lost on both sides, the death rates and employment, which is surprising because we have one of the youngest populations of those 20 countries. Our average median age is about 37 and a half years. Now, you take Germany, for example, their median age is 48 years, over 10 years older on average for their average population than the United States. Yet they had a death rate of about half the United States, as I recall, 1,800 versus 3,300 for the United States, 1,800 per million in Germany, 3,300 over during the pandemic for the United States. But the Germans had Angela Merkel, who at the beginning of the pandemic gave a speech, which is considered maybe the best speech given during the pandemic, saying to her fellow Germans that we are faced with a danger that we have not faced since the Second World War. And this is a danger called COVID, and we're going to have to make sacrifices we haven't made in generations to keep our citizens safe. And Germans, frankly, for being what they are, followed her rules and, for the most part, quarantined themselves, restricted transportation when necessary. It did a number of things to keep public health in the forefront, but it affected their economy, and they had significant, not unemployment, because German companies don't tend to let people off, but the GDP dropped significantly and affected their economy significantly. So there was a trade-off there. But relative to other countries, we did poorly, and people like to think about Sweden was a country that kept the country completely open and they benefited from that. But that's not true. They kept the country open the first 9 months. And then when death rates began to soar compared to other European countries, they began to follow public health measures in late 2020, began closing businesses earlier, and then even schools in 21 and 22, and wound up having death rates, which were slightly above the average, as I recall, for European countries. So there was no easy solution, but we in the United States did not find a happy medium between keeping people safe and alive and keeping an economy up and running. We did not find that compromise.
Now, I don't know the specifics of Germany, but my impression was that the European countries were far more successful at replacing wages. I mean, I think even keeping them replaced at 100%. We also had, in fact, incomes in many cases went up in the U.S. during the pandemic because people were getting checks, but it was unevenly done. There were a lot of small businesses that had really a lot of difficulty in accessing funds to maintain their financial health while they were closed down. So my sense is that Europe did that much more successfully than the U.S. And is that really the key in maintaining the social buy-in to the kinds of restrictive measures that the Europeans carried out?
Well, that's a good point. It's a little ironic in that the European countries, and in particular the Asian countries like Japan and South Korea, as soon as people began social distancing and locking down, rather than laying off employees, these countries tended to keep those employees employed, working and getting a paycheck. Although they may have reduced hours, they may have reduced pay, but they stayed on the payroll, and unemployment was much, much less in those countries. Whereas the United States, the companies laid off people by the millions. As I recall, 11.5 million people in the first few months were laid off by companies, but that was made up by government payments by under both President Trump and President Biden, $5 trillion in money dispensed to companies, which eventually wound up in the hands of people, which, as among other things, resulted in extreme inflation by 2022. But it was the government which financed the pandemic in the United States, which arguably was socialistic, whereas in the other developed countries, Europe and particularly Asia, it was primarily the companies that kind of bit the bullet and kept people employed, even though it hurt profitability for those companies. So that was a little bit of a surprising change between how we Americans like to think of ourselves as highly capitalistic and the Europeans as socialistic. The reverse of that actually happened during the pandemic.
So you wrote this book not just for the present, but you say for historians a century from now, and hopefully we'll still have a civilization a century from now. What do you hope that they will take away about how America handled COVID-19? Because this is not the last pandemic. And in fact, many scientists think it wasn't even the big one.
Well, that's a difficult question. What I'd like to think, if they were to take away only one or two items from my book, is the damage that disinformation can do during a national crisis, whether that's a pandemic or whatever that might be, because it was disinformation as much as anything, and lack of clear communication, even if it was unintentional, that did so much damage. And to me, that would be the primary takeaway. I would hope that historians 50 years, 100 years from now might recall from what we did during the 2020 pandemic.
Well, Ronald Gruner, it's such an interesting book. You've got loads of data in it, and it's very clearly written, COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. And I want to thank you for talking with us here about it.
Well, Francesca, thank you for the opportunity.
Ronald Gruner is also the author of another history, We the Presidents. Next up, help for getting published. Stay tuned after the break.
When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, a fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name, and you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, a fever all through the night.
That was Peggy Lee singing Fever. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. The publishing industry is dominated by just 5 big publishers. At the same time, as my next guest Dennis Sweeney says, it's ever more easy for writers to submit their work for publication, with no guarantee of success, of course. In fact, media concentration and ease of access make it ever harder to get noticed. But Sweeney says there's an alternative for writers seeking publication, a plethora of small presses and literary magazines. If you're willing to moderate your dreams of fame and fortune and expand your search for community, these outlets are much more likely to give you a home for your work. Sweeney's book, How to Submit, is a practical handbook for writers trying to get their work published in these smaller venues. Drawing on his own experience as a poet and editor, Sweeney breaks down the submissions process, rejection, community building, and sustaining motivation as a writer. Dennis James Sweeney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book, How to Submit, and we're not talking about, you know, some kinky sex or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, no worries.
Getting your writing published with literary magazines and small presses, it's not just a guide for an author, but it's also a guide to the landscape of indie publishing, as well as submitting your work to it. You begin with the story of a famous writer who's not named, who says she never submitted to the, quote, slush pile. And for those of our listeners who don't know what that means, you can tell us. What did that moment reveal to you about literary publishing? And why did it spark the urge to write this book?
So we were sitting in this room at a sort of publishing session at my MFA. And like you said, this famous writer came who still remains unnamed. You know, I don't want to send her up because she's a great writer, but she just didn't have to participate in this particular thing that we call the slush pile. And the slush pile is where when you send your writing to a publication, it's sort of the submissions queue, where the submissions kind of stack up and then editors eventually read them. It's referred to with this kind of derogatory name, slush pile, but it's actually this wonderful place where all these great submissions come from and everything like that. And the writer told us that she had never participated in this process of submitting her writing to a publication. Like, she had kind of been one of these writers who was quote unquote anointed, as people like to say. She was had her writing pulled out of the group of MFA students where she was going to school, and the professor who kind of pulled out her writing sent it to an editor at the New Yorker. It got published. You know, then she got an agent, and she was never at all responsible for sort of sending out her own work and building her own writing career through submissions and stuff like that. And I realized when I was listening to her say this, first of all, oh my gosh, I was really jealous of that process. It's really hard to do submissions and send out your writing and to go walk that whole path. But then I realized also there's a lot that you can miss by not doing that, right? And so my story has been completely different. It's been this kind of process of becoming involved with small press publications and literary magazines and kind of building community with editors and fellow writers and all these other people who are sending out submissions, reading submissions, running their own publications. And even though that process can be difficult and it can take a lot longer to get published if you kind of don't have that moment of like being chosen, it's actually really powerful, and it really helps you connect with kind of some of the deep core of why we do writing. You know, it's a lot of people working as a labor of love and giving of their own passion to setting up the writing and publishing community. And then suddenly you get to be a part of that and you're actively involved in it if you're submitting your own writing.
And you say the deep core of why we do writing. And one of the very first questions you ask people in this book to consider is why do they want to publish? So talk about that. Why do we want to write, and the link with publishing?
So I asked students this question in some community writing workshops that I had been teaching around the same subject. The very beginning of the workshops, I had to figure out, why are we here? Like, what are we doing in the same space together trying to learn about publication? And so I asked, why do you want to submit your writing? Why do you want to seek publication? And it was kind of interesting because at first people wanted to have these kind of noble responses to it. You know, I want to share an important story, or, you know, I want to build community. I want to illuminate experiences that have been marginalized. Like, all these are really great answers. And eventually some brave soul would say, I also want validation for my writing. You know, like, I really want to be told that what I'm doing is good and what I'm doing is worthwhile, right? Because we put so much time into our writing lives and we put so much spirit into it. And that last point, that one that we're maybe a little more hesitant to admit, that sometimes it can even feel selfish, right? This desire to have people see us and understand our communication. For me, that was something really important to key in on with the groups that I was originally working with before I even wrote this book, because it allowed us to move from the sense of logistical sort of strategic planning as writers who want to get published, you know, thinking of it as this kind of like soulless or impersonal process, it allowed us to move to a place where we realized it was really personal and it was really deep and involved with the reasons that we come to the page every single day. You know, I think the way I like to frame it is the deep need to be heard or the deep need to communicate with other people. And that doesn't just stop after you've written what you need to write and after you've gotten every single comma and period in the book that you're writing, you know, to a T. To me, it continues into the process of publication because then you're working with editors, you're interacting with readers, you're trying to find what it means to build an audience and what it means to connect authentically with people who are interested in your writing. And that's also that same moment of communication, just extended out beyond the page and into more public world.
And kind of along that line, you reframe the act of submission, which I think, you know, even within that word, it's a kind of one down place. You reframe it as finding a home for your writing. So why is that shift in language and mindset so important?
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, there's sort of these kinky sex like implications that sometimes come with the title of the book. And I've had people ask me about that. And, you know, that's related to forms of dominance and submission that are consensual and that everybody's on board with, of course. But there's also this kind of negative connotation that comes with submission in a writing sense, like you said, implies this hierarchical setup where there's a gatekeeper and there's somebody who's trying to, you know, vet your writing and decide whether it's good enough and whether you're worthwhile and whether your project is something that, you know, matters to other people. And then you have to sort of wait to see what happens. You're sort of submitting yourself to this larger kind of scary process. And I think that's really important to acknowledge, you know, that feeling that there can be these gatekeepers out there and that you're trying to break into this world that like maybe doesn't want to accept you or feels like it doesn't want to accept you. And when I was talking about these complicated meanings of the word submit in one of these early classes where I was teaching folks about this subject, one student spoke up and they were like, maybe you don't need to think about it in that sort of hierarchical way. Maybe you can think about it as submitting not to another person or to a institution, but actually submitting as an offering, right? Like submitting something, giving it up to the universe in a way that you choose to do and in a way that you kind of engage in that process in an intransitive sense rather than the transitive sense of submitting to someone. And that really reframed my thinking around it because it helped me understand that, you know, by giving ourselves to this process, it's not a way of like putting our fate in somebody else's hands. It's actually a way of accepting that we're inherently in conversation with other people and we're inherently trying to connect with other people. And the editors are doing the same thing, you know, when they're on the other end of the transom. Like people who work in the publishing business typically are really doing it because they love it and because they want to communicate as well. And they want to find those words that really mean something to them. So as soon as you realize that you're kind of submitting yourself to this larger process that we're all involved in and all kind of giving our hearts to me, it becomes a less intimidating process working on publishing your writing. And it becomes, like I said, kind of an extension of the creative process.
Let's talk about rejection. You say in this book, Dennis James Sweeney and How to Submit, that you have received countless rejections. You've regularly reevaluated your writing and even questioned your drive to pursue publication. So tell me, as someone myself who has been cut off at the knees with just a few rejections, what kept you going?
Yeah, I have to say, you know, I say countless rejections, but probably if I could, if I had to, I could count them up because it's all documented. It's all there. It would be in the many hundreds, probably the thousands. And it's really hard to experience that. Like you said, you know, even just a few things coming through saying, hey, we don't want to publish this piece of writing. It's really easy to feel like, oh, maybe it's not worthwhile. Maybe I shouldn't put my heart into this thing because it's such like a gift of the spirit to just keep putting your energy into the writing that you're creating. And so the first thing I think we have to always do is just acknowledge that feeling, acknowledge how much it can hurt to not receive an acceptance for your writing. And then we take a deep breath and we move on to sort of the next thought, which I would suggest to be the realization that this is something that's happening to everybody, no matter how successful you are. People are just stacking up rejections. And that's largely because the literary world has become so accessible. Like, people are able to submit their writing really widely. Like, anybody can send their work to an agent. Anybody can send their work to a literary magazine or a small press. And what that means is that there's tons of submissions out there and tons of great pieces in the submissions queue that editors are always having to read. So when we realize that, it becomes less of a sense of, like, this is a judgment on our work than a sense that there's all this great stuff out there and our particular thing didn't work for the particular people we sent it to at that one time. But that could also feel like sort of a bromide, right, when you're just receiving the rejections, which is all that happens until you get that acceptance, right? And so I like to think about it as also a way to help us reevaluate our writing and really come to terms with it. So this is kind of the third thought that I would advocate for us to have when we're going through this like series of almost grieving after getting a lot of rejections or even just one. For me, the third thought is when we take a look at our writing, look really closely at it and say, hey, do I really care about this enough to keep pursuing publication, even in the face of the difficulty of that process? And for me, that's been a really elucidating process, because earlier in my writing life, you know, I was writing a lot of short stories. I was really interested in formal experimentation and doing things that had interesting sentences and interesting concepts, but maybe didn't have as deep of an emotional core to them. And a lot of those pieces I would send out, they'd get a little bit of good feedback, like these positive rejections that people send saying, we like the work, but, you know, we don't want to publish it this time, send us more in the future. But after a while, I didn't feel like it was worth it to me to really double down, keep revising those pieces and send them out no matter what. But more recently, I've been doing a lot of writing that I'm really close to personally. Like, for example, some stuff about chronic illness. I have inflammatory bowel disease, so I've kind of been dealing with that my whole life and been trying to tell the story that is really difficult to tell because it involves going to the bathroom and it involves, you know, a lot of bodily functions that people don't like to talk about. So I've been trying to kind of develop a language for that. And after getting rejections for these stories, you know, it's a totally different experience. I feel like, oh, I really need to double down on this. I need to keep revising. I need to keep doing whatever I can do to get this out there. And to me, that's actually really helpful in the end to have that kind of sense of certainty and belief in your own writing. So ideally, you know, rejections come through. You realize that it's not personal. You realize it's just part of how things work. And there's a lot of people out there who want to read your writing. You're just still looking for the right person. And you come out of it with a sense of increased belief in the writing that you really care about. Because I really do believe that finding a home for your writing is about finding that home. It's really not something that happens easily necessarily, but I do think there's somebody out there who's going to understand what you're trying to do and believe in it with you and then bring it into the world in that way. It might not be the exact thing you thought. It might not be the New Yorker, right? You might have to look a little deeper and become more integrated with communities of writing to understand who that audience is and who the editors are who really are going to connect with your work. But once you do that, I think it can feel a lot more like a home because you've become integrated with the community. You've thought more about who it is that you really want to speak to.
And we are talking with Dennis James Sweeney about his book, How to Submit, Getting Your Writing Published with Literary Magazines and Small Presses. So this is key. Literary magazines, mostly for short form pieces, small presses for short form and long form. You offer a powerful defense of small presses and literary magazines not as fallback options, but as vital spaces for inclusion. What do they offer that big publishers often cannot?
Yeah, I was just writing a post about this on my Substack because recently people probably know about this already, but a lot of grant money was taken away by the NEA from people who were promised grant money to support particularly literary arts organizations, but a lot of other arts organizations as well. And a lot of literary magazines and small presses suffered because of that. And that's because literary magazines and small presses typically aren't extremely well-funded, and they're not focused on their bottom line. Like, a lot of people are getting into this work because they really want to publish books and they really want to do this thing, but they're doing it on the side when they have a main job that's doing something else. Or maybe there's one or two full-time paid staff at a small press. Or maybe if you're at a literary magazine, there's some folks who are working on their MFA or their PhD who are contributing free labor to the magazine to make sure that submissions get read and that all the logistical work gets done. So there's a lot of folks just cobbling it together, trying to make it work with lit mags and small presses. And that can be a limitation sometimes on resources. But to me, it's really a strength because it allows these organizations, these publishing venues, not to be beholden to the market in the same way that most big five publishers are, most sort of more professionalized publishers are. There are professionalized small presses out there, but again, they often rely on like grants and nonprofit sort of ways of raising money to fund them. And this allows them to do a lot of stuff that more commercially focused presses, like presses who need to sell a lot of books to survive, can't quite do. So for example, small presses and lit mags can publish authors with more marginalized points of view, or authors who are themselves been marginalized in the literary establishment in the past, things that styles as well that might not be money making, but that might be really important, might be breaking really important new ground in literature, and ultimately pave the way for larger presses to publish work like that. It also allows personal contact, like really deep personal contact, not just between editors and writers, but between everybody at an organization and the writer who's publishing with them. So for me, for example, a lot of the presses that I've published with, you know, it hasn't just been this professional relationship, bing, bang, boom, we do the process of publishing the book and that's it. Not that it's that way with the larger presses, right? But the roles are a little more delimited in that context. For me, with smaller presses, a lot of times I'll publish my book or my chapbook or my, you know, literary magazine piece with somebody, and then I'll end up doing a reading with them and listening to their work like 2 months later and getting to understand, you know, their poetry a little bit better. And then ultimately, maybe I get involved in a publishing project that they're also working on and contribute a little bit of labor to that. And suddenly I'm seeing them at the annual writers conference. We're saying hello, we're hanging out. I'm buying the t-shirt for their cool literary magazine and wearing it around Amherst, you know? And so there's all these deep kind of points of contact that come out of working in the small press and literary magazine community. Again, it's not an exclusive thing, right? It's not something that's not happening with big five publishing or with more commodified forms of publishing. But I think when we're focused on something different than just having to make money and having to make sure a book makes money, suddenly everybody becomes more focused on like a different type of economy. The gift economy is the one that I've mostly heard folks in these communities talk about, where you're kind of just putting your energy into the pot, you know, giving of what you have. And then when you need something back, you get something back as well. And it's not so transactional. It's not so based on exchange. It's more based on like everybody giving what they can to the community of publishing and of writing.
And we're talking with Dennis Sweeney about his book, How to Submit. That's great. And you're really describing a more kind of horizontal rather than hierarchical form of work. It's more about collaboration. And I love that idea of the gift economy. So let's talk about some of the practical things. You ran entropy.org's Where to Submit list, which closed down, I guess, in 2021. And you offer extensive advice about finding venues. What are some of your top tips for writers just beginning their search?
Yeah, so Entropy is this great website that really has some of the main qualities of the lit mags that I was just talking about. You know, it was this place where there was this horizontal relationship between all of the editors. Janice Lee was the person really running the show, but she just spread power out to everybody and did not try to control what anybody did. And I had this great opportunity to help out with this one list that they published that compiled really long lists of small presses and literary magazines where people could publish each season. And it became kind of an online event when these went up. The website's no longer running, but it was this great, beautiful moment in online literary stuff. And so for me, one of the top tips for writers that are just coming to the beginning of the submission process is first to make use of the resources you have, right? There's a lot of really great stuff out there, particularly resources that are compiled by fellow writers. Like Clifford Garstang and Erica Krause both have these wonderful lists that they've compiled of literary magazines, ranking them based on the amount of awards that pieces in those literary magazines have won over the past 5 or 10 years. And so you can get a great sense of like the relative prestige of literary magazines by looking at those lists. And there's a lot of other great lists out there that I've provided, you know, in my book and on my Substack that you can access. And those are really helpful places to begin to get a sense of sort of the breadth of the literary community out there and places you can potentially publish. But then the number one thing I would suggest to do after that, after getting that sort of broad sense, is to start looking into what you're really interested in, what you really care about, and doing like in-depth research and starting to do that pretty soon. You could rely on these kind of lists that rank things in terms of prestige or on these more lateral giant databases like Poets and Writers and CLMP have. You could rely on those for all of your submitting life. But for me, it's way more rewarding when you use those as a jumping off point to get involved in publications. And getting involved sometimes means contributing your labor, like helping out by doing some reading of submissions or helping out with a reading series or just kind of like helping out with something that a literary organization needs. But it doesn't have to be that directly involved, right? For me, getting involved also has to do with just reading the stuff that these publishers put out. So subscribing to a couple of literary magazines, ordering books from small presses you're interested in from your local library and buying some maybe a few times a year, and then using the publishers that you're reading to guide your future reading, if that makes sense. So a lot of us will read a writer and we'll say, oh, that writer's amazing. I want to find out what else they published. And that's a great way to do it. But you can also, especially if you're reading in small presses, you can read a book. If you really like it, then find out what else the small press published, because you're likely to find some kindred pieces in their next book because it's the same editors putting it on, but it might be very surprising to you in other ways. And so if you read with this sort of publication sense in mind, then you can eventually find your ways to places that don't have this feeling of like, oh, it's this distant publication venue that I ultimately have to submit to kind of blindly. Instead, you have it as an integrated part of your life. Like when you submit to them, when you write your cover letter, you can say, hey, I've been reading your books for years. And, you know, they've actually really influenced the writing that I've done since then. And that's why I'm submitting my book to you, right? And so suddenly it becomes a much more integrated process of submitting when you're doing research like that, instead of just looking at these lists and looking at the website and sort of not involving yourself in a more deep way. You can, of course, do that on social media and things like that too, following publishing organizations, lit mags, small presses, etc., and just seeing how they represent themselves online. All these are ways to integrate it with your life and to make it feel like, hey, I'm already a part of this community. So by the time you come to the cover letter and the submission process itself, then you're already there, right? You're not trying to jump into a place that is being gatekept. Like, you're already inside the gate.
Now, you also provide detailed advice about crafting a cover letter and also managing submissions, but you also emphasize intuition. So how do you balance structuring your strategy with gut instinct, with intuiting where to go?
I think strategy works up until you actually come to the individual person who's on the other side of the submission process, right? Being strategic, you know, when you're making a cover letter, for example, involves communicating really important stuff at the very beginning of the cover letter, right? For example, like, I got a positive rejection from you last year and, you know, you said to submit again, so I'm submitting again. Then they're going to read your piece a little more closely. Or, you know, I have this close relationship with your publication because I've been reading it for a while. Those things can all be kind of advantageous and strategic to say in a cover letter. But fundamentally, like, they're about personal relationships, right? It's not really about strategy when you're doing that. And that's when strategy sort of fades into this more intuitive feeling. I guess I would say that, like, the best strategy is intuition or is, like, following and uniting with your intuition, going toward the types of publication venues that feel good to you. Because as we talked about at the beginning, you know, why to submit, why you want to send out your writing has to be really central to your process, because otherwise you can get really obsessed with like prestige or with, you know, things that don't actually matter to you. And if you stay connected to your reasons for doing it, which to me has to do with staying connected to your intuition, you're just going to be a lot more happy with the process, right? You're going to do things that actually make you happy and make you enjoy your writing life instead of getting swept up in narratives that you yourself didn't create. So I think staying connected to your intuition is like one way to make it an enjoyable process instead of a stressful one that it can often be.
There's also a sense that you have to really allow for time in this. Talk a little bit about, you know, how to manage expectations when you submit your work.
Yeah, I think that's the one for me. You know, when we write something, especially for me, I can write something and then have this sense of like, I need to get this published right away. It's so urgent to me. It's so immediate. It's ready to go. It's the best thing I've ever written. And, you know, if you're anything like me, you've had that experience of thinking that one day and then waking up 2 weeks later, looking at the thing you wrote and realizing it needs like several weeks, several months, maybe several years of revision. So that's the first time that we have to cross together, right? Which is just like giving yourself time to get to know your own writing and really understand what you're doing and revise it and make it as you know, communicative as you can. But the problem is it also takes a long time to get published a lot of times, right? And the response times can be forever, sometimes 6 months to a year. And because rejections are just part of the normal course of things, you might send something out 20, 30, maybe even 40 times before you get an acceptance. Definitely for smaller pieces. And then for full-length books, you might send it out like 50, 60 more times than that. I've sent my books out sometimes that many times. And so you're often waiting a long time, and that process can be very difficult because you're trying to move on to other writing, but you still haven't published this one thing. But for me, the way that that's been kind of educational and helpful has been that it gives me an insight on my work that I haven't had in the past, right? You sort of, even if your book doesn't change that much or you're revising it a little bit, but it's still staying fundamentally the same book, you suddenly understand more about yourself as a writer. You develop like a deeper relationship with the thing that you're doing just by virtue of not only waiting to see if you get an acceptance for it, but also by virtue of just getting those responses, having to evaluate them, like I said before, and constructing the cover letters and materials that you need around it. So that time can really give you the chance to know your work. And then when you do publish it, you can speak to folks about how much you know your work, right? And say all these things that are maybe adding to the conversation even more than the book itself. Like for me with How to Submit, for example, this book actually happened relatively fast relative to my other stuff. Everything else I've written took like 5 years to get published. This was relatively fast. But in the interim between, you know, getting it accepted and then ultimately writing and publishing it, I have had a lot of time to think about, like, what does this mean in the larger conversation? Like, what am I trying to say about it? And so anything I'm saying right now, you know, is a product of that time between constructing something and then being able to share it with the world. So it's kind of a gift, even though it can be frustrating at the same time.
Well, the book is How to Submit, Getting Your Writing Published with Literary Magazines and Small Presses. And Dennis James Sweeney, it's just been great to talk with you about this.
Oh, it's so great to talk with you as well. I love your questions, and I just really appreciate like how deeply you're seeing what I'm hopefully trying to do with the book.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to more resources from Dennis Sweeney on how to submit your work to small publishers and literary magazines. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Bridget Crocker about River Daughter, her memoir of being a river rafting guide on some of the most spectacular rivers in the world. Don't miss it. And I have exciting news. I've started hosting a new podcast for Change Hampton, an organization dedicated to promoting a new land ethic that creates habitat for wildlife, birds, and beneficial bugs. The podcast name is Change Hampton Presents, Changing the World, One Yard at a Time. Look for it wherever you get your podcasts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.